It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and today we're remembering an American literary genius.
Please welcome David Foster Wallace.
He was a literary rock star during his lifetime, a literary legend after his suicide in 2008. And now David Foster Wallace is the subject of a new Hollywood movie. But this hour, we'll meet him in his own words.
I don't know if you guys suffer from this phenomenon. When I can tell that the person on stage is nervous, I get nervous for him. It's a horrible feeling. And I will be really nervous for the first 2 or 3 minutes. But don't fret, because the minute I forget about myself and get interested in what I'm doing, it goes away. So I just wanted to let you know we'll all be fine. The excerpt that I'm going to read is from a long story that's set in a...
That is so typical of David Foster Wallace, in person and in his writing. That acutely observant mind, the almost painful self-awareness, and the humor and the charm. He was a dazzling writer. People teach entire college courses on his novel, Infinite Jest. His nonfiction essays are so sharp and so funny, one inspired a Simpsons episode. And at this point, you may be wondering, okay, what did he actually write about?
My name is Laura Miller, and I am the book critic for Salon.com. David Foster Wallace was the most important writer of his time because he tried harder than anybody else, really, to figure out what it meant to live in a world where we are so conscious of how we appear to other people that we almost lose the ability to be ourselves. That was really the central theme of his work, this quest for some kind of authenticity of the self. And one of the hardest things for contemporary fiction writers to do is write in a meaningful way about living in a society that's completely saturated by media and where television and the internet and other forms of broadcast media are so much more powerful of a presence in people's lives than the written word. And David Foster Wallace was willing to really tackle that head on. And I always felt that David Wallace's work made me work harder and brought out the best in me as a reader and as a critic more than any other writer whose work I have ever written about.
The most famous book David Foster Wallace wrote is Infinite Jest. It's a huge, sprawling novel full of multiple storylines, digressions, footnotes. There are sentences that go on for pages. It's about family relationships and rehab and suicide and film theory and tennis. And at the center of it is an imaginary movie. David Foster Wallace talked with us about it back in 1996 when it was just out. And looking back now, what he had to say then was kind of prophetic.
I think the standard agenda of any piece of entertainment is to be as entertaining as possible. The problem with the movie Infinite Jest is that it's lethally entertaining, meaning it's watching it is so much more fun than doing anything else. Once somebody's watched it once, they pretty much have the spiritual energies of a moth and want to do nothing more than watch it again and again and again until they die of probably dehydration. The book is meant to seem kind of surreal and outlandish at first, and then in sort of a creepy way to seem not all that implausible. I mean, at some point in the next 10 or 15 years, we're going to have virtual reality pornography, which I would just invite you to think about, given the level of, you know, people whose lives are ruined just by addiction to sort of video peep show stores now. This stuff's going to get better and better and better and better, and it's not clear to me that we as a culture are teaching ourselves or our children, you know, what we're going to say yes and no to. A lot of really ecstatic pleasures are linked, interestingly, sort of with death. I guess my point is right now, and I think the next 15 or 20 years are going to be a very scary and sort of very exciting time when we have to sort of reevaluate our relationship to fun and pleasure and entertainment, because it's going to get so good and so high pressure that we're going to have to forge some kind of attitude toward it that lets us live. The first leading cause of death among teenagers is suicide. Drug addiction, sexual addiction, gambling addiction in this country is epidemic. The divorce rate is sky high. I mean, people in this country are lost and wandering around and looking to give themselves away to something that will maybe love them back as much as they love it. I know that in certain moods, when I'm tired or when I'm in some sort of pain, I want kind of infantile pleasures. I want to sit and receive pleasure without having to give anything or do anything. The question, I think, is sort of an individual one, is that what level of pain do we need to reach before we begin to be willing to undertake the work of that reevaluation? This is a very long and fairly difficult book that I also wanted not to be a standard kind of avant-garde book, most of which right now I admire as a writer but just aren't very much fun to read. So I wanted it to be both long and difficult but also to be fun enough, you know, so the reader wouldn't throw it at the wall on page 100. And I realize that sets up certain ironies since the book itself is about entertainment.
David Foster Wallace, from a conversation we had with him nearly 20 years ago. A lot has happened since then. Most tragically, his suicide 7 years ago at age 46. And today he's probably even more famous than he was then. There's a whole cult of DFW. The TV show Parks and Recreation did an episode that was an homage to him. The Simpsons based an episode on one of his essays. And then there's the new movie about him. But what is it about his work that continues to inspire such devotion? Steve Paulson asked Stephen Byrne, the scholar who's editing Wallace's letters.
Stephen, I can't think of any other contemporary novelist who would become the subject of a big Hollywood film. How do you explain the continuing fascination with David Foster Wallace?
Well, I think there are probably two reasons why Wallace has an unusual level of fame. First of all, I think that unlike a lot of other writers, there's something about Wallace's work that requires more than usual readerly devotion. If you sit down with Infinite Jest, you can't sort of read just a chapter or two in a busy waiting room and expect to maintain the thread of it.
You almost have to be a true fan to read his fiction, at least.
It inspires that, yeah. It requires it and it inspires it.
Now, you said there's another reason why he's so famous.
I think there's a sense in which Wallace always stood for something larger than just his writing. When he published his first book, The Broom of the System, he pitched it to his agent in terms of a growing interest in very young writers, and he was in his 20s. And as he goes on through his career, Infinite Jest, obviously by sheer scale, it attracted a lot of attention that's, again, separate from what's in the book itself, the fact of the book, the size of the book. Began to attract attention.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of people who know this book, Infinite Jest, who've never read it, but they know about it, and they're kind of fascinated by the figure of David Foster Wallace. I mean, he somehow became kind of a cultural icon and more than just a famous writer.
Yeah. I mean, he has a global reach as well that seems almost unparalleled. There was a book published in Finland just this year called What Does David Foster Wallace Mean? and I was in Illinois earlier this year.
Where Wallace grew up.
Yeah, where Wallace grew up. I was in Bloomington Normal, where he was an English professor for many years. And it turned out that there are Italians who organize sort of tour groups to come on a kind of pilgrimage to see scenes from Wallace's life. Wallace does seem to have a magnetic attraction, a certain gravity to him that the other writers don't.
Are you part of the Wallace fan club?
I don't know. I'm not part of any online groups or anything like that.
Let me put it another way. Are you a Wallace obsessive?
You know, I have been a Wallace obsessive. When I first read Infinite Jest in the mid-1990s, it was obviously, from the very first pages, such a great book, a really major breakthrough. And it requires obsession to make sense of it. It requires you to recall tiny details across hundreds of dense, disorienting pages. But it can be a claustrophobic world to live within, the world of Wallace's fiction. I, at least, sometimes feel that I need to get out of that world.
Take me back to the time when Infinite Jest was published, and it really was this major literary phenomenon and kind of heralded the breakout of this writer who a lot of people recognized as having some sort of genius. What was unique about that book?
Well, if we go back to the 1990s, there were a lot of great books published in that decade, yet at the time, the perception of fiction in the 1990s was quite depressed. The New York Times Book Review in 1992 ran a front page feature on the rise of hypertext fiction under the inflammatory banner, the end of books. Infinite Jest appears in these depressed times as a work that seems almost deliberately designed to answer complaints about the fate of American fiction. The scale, the inventiveness, its vitality on a page-by-page basis made it, particularly in that time, a landmark in writerly ambition.
Now, we've been talking about the devotion, the fandom that David Foster Wallace still inspires. We haven't talked about how he died. I mean, he was clearly some sort of a tortured soul. I mean, struggled with, at times, crippling depression for much of his life. Of course, killed himself. How much does that play into the fascination with this writer?
There are two groups of people. There are the people who were reading him a long time before he committed suicide, and there are the people who come to him only through the shadow of his suicide. For the people who already knew his books, I think the tenor of some of his fiction has changed significantly. There are parts of Infinite Jest where Wallace talks very directly about depression. At the time, certainly when I first read them, they seemed to be simply descriptions, but they now have the flavor of documents of personal torment. I certainly think that Wallace has come to stand in the media more generally. He's come to index larger cultural fantasies about the tormented artist, and a lot of, I think, media outlets want the name David Foster Wallace, like that of Sylvia Plath or Virginia Woolf, to stand for that torment.
Does he still cast a huge shadow over the literary scene?
Yes, I think he does. I mean, his influence is remarkable. He appears as a character in a lot of other books. He's somewhere in the background of Richard Powers's novel Generosity, Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, Jeffrey Eugenides's The Marriage Plot. Both seem to have a character that's closely based upon Wallace.
And these were all writers who were roughly contemporaries of him. I mean, who knew him, and he turns up in their fiction then.
He does. I mean, I think more generally, his voice, I think, has a significant influence on contemporary writers on a sentence-by-sentence basis. Here's an example of one of those sentences. And this is picked more or less at random from Infinite Jest. And it's about 700 pages in. Maybe it's the fact that most of the arts here are produced by world-weary and sophisticated older people and then consumed by younger people who not only consume art but study it for clues on how to be cool and hip. And keep in mind that for kids and younger people, to be hip and cool is the same as to be admired and accepted and included and so unalone. What seems to me to be important about this sentence is the way in which it constantly qualifies itself, the way it refuses a sort of single meaning, the idea that answers aren't simple. The word "and" appears 8 times in that sentence, and that's what gives it a lot of its motion. And that, I think, is one of the things that's particularly special about Wallace's work, that this is a writer who believed in complexity and whose sentences constantly tried to move away from simplicity, to try and capture that movement of thought where we're constantly qualifying or adding and changing the substance of what goes before.
Stephen Byrne is a literary scholar at the University of Glasgow. He's now editing the selected letters of David Foster Wallace. He talked with Steve Paulson. So there's a reason David Foster Wallace is back in the news again, a reason he himself probably would have felt somewhat ambivalent about. There's a new movie out, The End of the Tour, starring Jason Segel as David Foster Wallace and Jesse Eisenberg as journalist David Lipsky. It's a true story about a road trip.
When I think of this trip, I see David and me in the front seat of his car. He wants something better than he has. I want precisely what he has already.
In 1996, David Foster Wallace had just turned 34. He was on a publicity tour for Infinite Jest when Rolling Stone sent a young reporter named David Lipsky to interview him.
What's this story about in your mind?
Just what it's like to be the most talked about writer in the country, that sort of thing.
You're like a nervous guy, huh?
No, I'm okay. How are you?
Because I'm terrified.
The two wound up spending 5 days on the road together. They talked about fame, sadness, friendship, movies, junk food. Lipsky later wrote a book about the experience. And a few years ago, he sat down with Jim Fleming to share his memories of David Foster Wallace.
He had all the anxieties that someone has when their first book is coming out, that sense of achievement, will it be as big as it seems to me? I've just spent a year on this. He'd written the first draft of the book, Broom of the System, during his senior year at Amherst. In any event, he was having a hard time writing without a schedule, and he thought, I've always done writing as a sideline to the academic work. I think I'll do great if I go back in an academic environment. So he joined. He got a full ride to get a PhD in philosophy at Harvard, which he somehow thought could be a part-time thing. But of course, the workload at Harvard was not at all what he expected.
And of course, he didn't then have the time in the evening to work on the writing that he'd hoped he would.
No, exactly. So he refers to that when he and I were talking, he spoke of that as being the bleakest time of his life. Mm. He was drinking at that point a lot to sort of self-medicate and having a terrible time, I think, actually writing fiction. And so that was how he ended up checking himself into the Harvard Student Health Center saying, look, I think there's a problem. I've been thinking about hurting myself. He ended up at McLean's, which has also been a host to Sylvia Plath and Robert Lowell, and then was prescribed Nurdle from then, I think, about November of 1989 on.
And that did seem to do the trick. I mean, no chemical is perfect, but it did seem to give him what he needed in order to get back on track.
Oh, yeah. You know, his first two books, Broom of the System and Girl with Curious Hair, both really strong. And then the stuff that he's famous for is stuff that he then, it had no negative effect. Whatever chemical it had to counteract, the Nurdle seems to have counteracted that and given him, you know, what readers know of him is all from 1989 on, basically.
And the problem that came up was his decision to go off the drug Nurdle. What happened?
He had been on Nurdle for about 20 years. Taking Nurdle wasn't perfect. And because David, when he was living out in California, was actually so very happy, right? He'd always wanted to be married. He'd made this great marriage. He had this great job at Pomona. You know, they'd made a chair for him. He was the Roy E. Disney, I think, professor of creative writing, which is funny for any reader of Infinite Jest because it's a subsidized academic chair. But he was incredibly happy. And so he thought now he'd eaten a meal that may have sort of catalyzed some of the, there are certain foods you can't eat if you're on Nurdle. And so he'd had a meal that he thought might have interacted badly with the drug. But he took that as an opportunity to say, look, I've been on this drug for 20 years. I'm really happy. I'm strong now. I'd like to get off this drug. And it didn't work. And then after a year of trying almost every other antidepressant available, they tried to go back on the Nurdle. And this is one of the great risks of going off a successful chemical agent like Nurdle. It no longer worked. So I wouldn't look at things like this is the story of genius gone bad or the candle that burns twice as bright lasts half as long. I think it's just a story about an incredibly confident and intelligent and vividly charming person who, because of strength and optimism, made a mistake.
As you write it, it sounds as though he really was trying to get through all of this. Looking back on it, do you feel differently about it?
Well, he had given the drugs 15 or 16 months to work. This started in June of 07, and now it was mid-September of 08. Now, as someone who knew him a little and loved his work, of course I wish that he had given it 5 years to work, 10 years. I wish he'd given it an infinite number of years. But he had lost 70 pounds in a year. He hadn't been sleeping. His parents came out to be with him about a month before he died. You know, he was sitting on the floor. You know, he wouldn't leave the house. He was afraid that his students would see him and see how he was. And one thing that really struck his father was his father said, as if the students would do anything but give him a hug, you know. And I mean, if you've ever gone without sleep for even a few days, if you can imagine a summer of really no sleep or a year of on and off no sleep, you can imagine the situation that he was in.
Yeah. Would he have been surprised, do you think, by the outpouring of affection for him, of admiration for him, of surprise that followed his death?
You know, it didn't surprise me as a reader of him because everyone I know, it was like maybe it's one of those things that's so much a given that it's not really a secret. But I think what really took the wind out of people was, in fact, not just how happy and funny he seems in his work, but how humane his sense of the world is, how humane his sense of life is. Because he's someone who's arguing always that, look, if you actually kind of learn to take some pleasure in the things that are particularly irritating or awful, and if you learn to kind of moderate the voice that Beller talks about inside you that says, I want, then in fact life can become this incredibly funny, sharp, alive thing. And that was what people, that's what a lot of people took from his work. I mean, it's an incredibly lively body of work. And so to have the author of that body of work suddenly dead by their own hand, I think is part of what was incredibly stunning to people.
That's David Lipsky talking with Jim Fleming. Lipsky wrote a book about David Foster Wallace called Although, Of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself. It's the basis for the new movie about David Foster Wallace that just opened called The End of the Tour. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking this hour about the late writer David Foster Wallace. Personally, I'm really looking forward to seeing the new movie about him. But the people who were closest to him, his family and editors, have been really critical about it. Mostly because they think David himself would have hated it. He wanted people to pay attention to his work, his words. So let's do that. Over the years, we interviewed David Foster Wallace a few times. The last occasion was in 2004. He just published a short story collection called Oblivion. And Steve Paulson asked him to begin by reading from one of them. It's a story about how horrified kids are when they look at their parents' lives.
I had begun having nightmares about the reality of adult life as early as perhaps age 7. I knew, even then, that the dreams involved my father's life and job and the way he looked when he returned home from work at the end of the day. His arrival was always between 5:42 and 5:45. What occurred was almost choreographic in its routine. He removed his hat and topcoat and hung the coat in the foyer closet, clawed his necktie loose with two fingers, entered the living room, greeted my brother, and sat down with the newspaper to wait for my mother to bring him a highball. It is in hindsight that I believe the dreams to have been about adult life, but I do not believe I knew or could even imagine, as a child, that for almost 30 years of 51 weeks a year, my father sat all day at a metal desk in a silent, fluorescent-lit room, breaking only occasionally to answer his telephone or meet with other actuaries in other bright, quiet rooms.
It's wonderful. So evocative. Did you have that kind of dread when you were a kid?
I think in a country where we have it as easy as we do, one of our big dread vectors is boredom. I think little edges of despair and soul-level boredom appear in things like homework or particularly dry classroom stuff. I can remember the incredible soaring relief of when certain teachers would say we were going to watch a movie in grade school. And it wasn't just a hedonistic, oh, we're going to have fun. It was a relief from some kind of terrible, terrible burden, I thought.
Did you sort of look at what your parents were doing or your father in particular and think, oh, my God, I don't want to become like that?
I mean, both my parents were teachers, so they always got pale and haunted looking when there were big stacks of papers to grade. But I think a lot of this has more to do with friends' parents and friends who've become kind of office workers. I just got interested in the reality of boredom, which is something that I think is a kind of hugely important problem, and yet none of us talk about it because we all act like it's just sort of something that we have to get through.
Well, it's funny because as I was reading that, I was sort of thinking back to my own childhood, and my father was a professor, and he would, after dinner, he would typically go on up into his study, close the door, and I don't know what he did, but I remember thinking when I was pretty little that this doesn't seem like fun to have to sort of do this night after night, and I didn't want to become like that. Of course, I sort of have become like that because, you know, I go home and, you know, I have my own homework as well. But I'm wondering if that resonated at all for you.
One of my little family stories that Mom always tells is that on the day in second grade when we all had to talk about what our fathers did for a living, I said my father didn't do anything for a living. He just stayed home and wrote on yellow paper. Because he was a professor too. I know that part of what interested me in the story was trying to remember what I thought about what my parents did when I was a child. Because when you're a child, I don't think you're aware of how incredibly easy you have it, right? You have your own problems and you have your own burdens and chores and things you have to do. But yeah, I think my intuitions were very much like yours. I think when they went into these quiet rooms and had to do things that it wasn't obvious they wanted to do, I think there was a part of me that felt that something terrible was coming.
Yeah. You know, what I find interesting about what we've been talking about and also the passage you just read is Your public image as a writer is you're typically described as one of the leading figures of the postmodern, hip, ironic generation of writers now in their 30s and early 40s. But I read somewhere that you really think of yourself as a realist.
You know, these various classifications are important for critics. I don't know very many writers who don't think of themselves as realists in terms of trying to convey the way stuff tastes and feels sort of to you. I mean, a lot of stuff that's like capital R realism just seems to me somewhat hokey. The idea that small, banal details are somehow more real or authentic than large or strange details always seem to me just a little bit crude. The truth of the matter is when you're in an interview, you have to say all kinds of stuff. I don't really know what I am. And I don't think very many writers have any idea what they are.
Well, I'm wondering about for particularly people of our generation, I think we're roughly around the same age, both in our early 40s, whether there's a certain cultural landscape that you feel most compelled to write about.
I know that when I was in graduate school, those of us who wrote very much about what used to be called pop culture or advertising or television were really scorned by our older professors who saw that stuff as kind of vapid and banal. And I remember it was a really big source of conflict because in lots of ways we just didn't get what they were saying. I mean, this was our world and our reality the same way, you know, the Romantics' world was trees and babbling brooks and mountains and blue skies. So I think probably if there's, I'm 42, if there's something that's distinctive about our generation is that we've been steeped in media and marketing since the time we were very, very small. And it's kind of a grand experiment because no other generation in the history of the world has been that mediated. What implications that has, I don't know, but I know it affects what seems urgent and worth writing about and what kind of feels real in my head when I'm working on it.
Isn't that also complicated, though? Because the danger of writing about, I don't know what you'd call mass culture or pop culture, is that it's going to seem shallow. In fact, you wrote an essay about this some years back, that the risk of just being clever. How do you say something original about this world that in so many ways is really pretty shallow?
Well, except for me, art that's alive and urgent is art that's about what it is to be a human being. There are certain paradoxes and there are certain hazards involved, I think, in writing about this world because there's the danger of being sucked into it and simply trying, for instance, to do something that seems very hip and clever and thinking the job has been done then. I've certainly done stuff like that and realized only later with horror that what I did was in fact just kind of regurgitated the same stuff that I've been hearing since I was 4 or 5. There's another side to it, though, is that I think at least for people like me, I'm 42 and I grew up, I don't know how many after-school specials and Hallmark Network things I've seen. A lot of what's quote-unquote realistic, conventionally realistic, ends up seeming hokey to me. Everything seems a little too convenient, and the ultimate goal of it is to sell me something. And there's a part of me, I think, that recoils from that. And that's a problem because some realistic stuff really is alive and urgent. But I think for a lot of us about our age, we're looking for different, less commercial forums in which to talk about kind of the urgent, moving stuff. I don't know whether that makes any sense, but that's pretty much the truth the way I see it.
Well, I think the other piece of that is a lot of this commercial world, I mean, whether it's movies or, I don't know, advertising even, it's pretty compelling. You know, it's entertaining.
Yeah.
And I suppose from a writer's perspective, you might want to feel like if you're going to write about this stuff, you have to be entertaining too.
It's a real problem. I don't have a TV anymore, but, you know, when I'm doing something like this and I'm on the road, I watch TV in hotels and I'm appalled by how good the commercials have gotten. They're fascinating. They're funny. They're hip. They've got trunk lines into my, you know, high school level anxieties and desires in a way that the commercials I grew up with never did. What it is a lot of them are the hip, cynical, cool people I went to college feeling intimidated by who are now making $2 million a year.
I mentioned this essay that you wrote, I think it was back in 1993, about writing and sort of what various fiction writers are up to. And one point you made is that irony tyrannizes us. The implicit message of irony is, I don't really mean what I'm saying. And you went on to suggest that the next generation of rebel writers might ditch irony in favor of sincerity, and I think I'm quoting here, who treat plain old untrendy human troubles and emotions with reverence and conviction, who eschew self-consciousness and hip fatigue. And I guess...
Yeah.
is that a critique of your own kind of writing?
I don't know that it's that. I mean, the thing even sounds dated to me now. I think it's less that than an articulation of the thing you were asking me about before is, you know, what is it like to be working really hard on the stuff at age 42, having been marketed to all your life? I mean, because you want your art to be hip and seem cool to people. You want people to like the stuff. But a great deal of what passes for hip or cool is now highly, highly commercially driven. And some of it I think is important art. I think The Simpsons is important art. On the other hand, it's also, in my opinion, relentlessly corrosive to the soul, and everything is parodied and everything is ridiculous. Maybe I'm old, but for my part, I can be steeped in about an hour of it, and then I sort of have to walk away and look at a flower or something. If there's something to be talked about, that thing is this weird conflict between what my girlfriend calls the inner sap, you know, the part of us that can really wholeheartedly weep at stuff, and the part of us that has to live in a world of smart, jaded, sophisticated people and wants very much to be taken seriously by those people. I don't know that it's that irony tyrannizes us, but the fashions that are so easy to criticize but are so incredibly powerful and authentic seeming when we're inside them tyrannize us. I don't know that it's ever been any different. That probably makes absolutely no sense.
No, it actually makes
total sense. That was my experiment at telling the truth.
It makes total sense. But can you hold those two impulses simultaneously?
No, but I think my personal opinion and what I tell my students is that if there's suffering involved in art, or however you want to say it, right now this is the form of the suffering, is to be the battleground for the war between those two kind of impulses, neither of which are stupid, neither of which are wrong. But it's not at all clear to me how to marry them. And I don't think it's been at all clear since about the 1950s. I just think it's where we're at. Hmm.
Is that what you're trying to do in your fiction, to sort of get at those two impulses within the same story?
For the purposes of this conversation, I'll say yes. But sitting in the bright, quiet room in front of the paper, it's much more, oh, does this make me want to throw up? Does this seem real? Is this the sort of thing the person would say? It's much more kind of boneheaded and practical than that. You realize this, right? There's something very artificial about once the book's all through galleys and, you know, now I'm engaging in critical discourse about it. I might be right, but it's very different than what it's like actually to do the things.
That's David Foster Wallace talking with Steve Paulson in 2004. Really makes you miss him, doesn't it?
I'm Lev Grossman, the book critic for Time magazine. There's an old joke that Woody Allen used to tell about how he cheated on his philosophy exam. He gazed into the soul of the boy next to him. That's what David Foster Wallace did. He gazed into everybody's soul. When you read his writing, you thought this is a person who knows everything. And he was the greatest writer of dialogue that there was. Nobody else rendered the spoken speech of Americans the way he did. Nobody rendered it as accurately, as lovingly, as funnily, as hilariously as Wallace. He actually made you love the way Americans talked, which is not an easy thing to do. But more than that, in a strange way, he took that language into himself. He was a ventriloquist who he could take on any voice. And I think he showed us the corruption of the language around us by reproducing it. He drew it into himself, and somehow he was able to sort of tolerate its sickness and then reproduce it on the page so that we could really look at it and see what was wrong with it. That must have taken an incredible strength, an incredible power to kind of confront what was wrong with our culture. And it's astounding that he did that. And having seen him do it, we all saw him do it. It was as if he could do anything and endure anything. It turns out that he couldn't. But I think we should all forgive ourselves for thinking he could.
You're listening to an hour about David Foster Wallace. Coming up, we'll talk with his sister, Amy Wallace Havens, and hear one of the most widely shared things he ever wrote, a commencement speech he gave at Kenyon College. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. I feel kind of embarrassed admitting this, but I've never actually made it all the way through Infinite Jest, David Foster Wallace's most famous novel. But what I do love, and have read more than once, are his essays, which have their own cult following. For instance, there's one, a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again, which is a hilarious diatribe about cruise ships. It even inspired an episode of The Simpsons called A Totally Fun Thing That Bart Will Never Do Again. In that one, Bart goes on a cruise with his family and he loves it, which is, of course, the polar opposite of David's experience. Here's the original.
I have seen a lot of really big white ships. I have seen schools of little fish with fins that glow. I have seen a toupee on a 13-year-old boy. The glowing fish like to swarm between our hull and the cement of the pier whenever we docked. I have seen the north coast of Jamaica. I have seen and smelled all 145 cats inside the Ernest Hemingway residence in Key West, Florida. I now know the difference between straight bingo and prizo and what it is when a bingo jackpot, quote, snowballs. I have seen camcorders that practically required a dolly. I've seen fluorescent luggage and fluorescent sunglasses and fluorescent pince-nez and over 20 different makes of rubber thong. I have heard steel drums and eaten conch fritters and watched women in silver lamé projectile vomit inside a glass elevator. I have pointed rhythmically at the ceiling to the 2-4 beat of the exact same disco music I hated pointing at the ceiling to in 1977.
This doesn't exactly sound like a fun experience, was it?
It was an experience where you were so relentlessly bombarded by the attentions of people whose high-paid job was to make sure you were having fun that to say whether it was fun or not, it ends up becoming meaningless. It was fun with a capital F in ITAL with quotes around it, and it was kind of crazy-making. I should also add, I went on this thing by myself, and I and a very troubled man who was surgically attached to a camcorder were the only two people on this cruise who were not there as part of a couple, and I think it would have been very different for me if I'd had someone to, quote-unquote, share the experience with.
Well, give me a sense of the luxury on a cruise like this. How far does it go?
Well, this is sort of the fantasy vacation, and what it promises you is you're not going to have any problems on this. I mean, it got to, you know, you're sunning. You're sunning in a chair, but it's not a regular chair at a pool. It's a specially designed chair with a special material that absorbs your perspiration as you're perspiring so you don't get those hideous, you know, those sounds when you sweat on a plastic lounge chair and then shit. You don't get that. They're incredible. They're towels that you know, want to have personal relationships with, and they're all stacked, you know, near this towel bin, and you don't have to get the towel. A swarthy person brings the towel to you. It ends up being sort of like staying with, you know, the over-solicitous host who wants to do absolutely everything for you, and you end up in these really Abbott and Costello, you know, do you carry your own tray in the cafeteria, or do you let this guy who's 80 years old and clearly has terrible arthritis carry your tray for you? Well, you feel horribly guilty if you let him carry the tray, but if you carry your own tray, it turns out he gets in trouble for having let you carry his tray. I mean, it was a nightmare of a very particular sort.
That's David Foster Wallace talking with Steve Paulson about his essay, A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, the essay that convinced many of us that we should never, ever, ever go on a cruise.
He would never use an ATM machine because he didn't get it. But he was probably the best listener I have ever met in my life. He loved to sit down and talk to people about anything.
That's Amy Wallace Havens describing her late brother David Foster Wallace. And unlike everyone else we've heard in this hour, Amy didn't care whether David was famous or not famous, or even whether he was a writer. He was just her big brother. We talked about a year after David's death.
He was sort of benevolently sadistic, if that makes any sense at all. He very much enjoyed figuratively pulling my wings off and then watching what happened. He knew every button to push to make me hysterical. He was, you know, 2 years older and that much smarter, and he was always a lot bigger than I was. Probably the funniest thing that he did when he was a kid, during the long, gray, boring winters when there just isn't that much to do, once in a while, he would decide that day he wasn't going to be David. He was going to be Captain Phlegm and his sidekick, Goatbile. And he would be both of them at once. And I don't really remember what their purpose was or what if they had superpowers or what they actually did. But I can still you know, shudder thinking I used to beg my brother to be allowed to be goat bile on a Sunday afternoon. And I wasn't worthy. He would do them both himself.
So your brother had his first brush with depression when he was still living at home. Do you remember that time?
Yes, yes, I do. He had left for college, and he came back his sophomore year in the middle of the year unexpectedly. And this just stunned all of us. We had absolutely no idea what he was going through and what he was struggling with. And that was a very memorable and difficult time.
That must have been really hard for you as little sister to see your big brother come home like that.
It was really scary because he'd always been big and strong and he could do anything. But I do remember when he came back from Amherst in the middle of the year, we would sit in his bedroom when I got home from school. And sometimes he would get in my mom or dad's car and just drive around and try to find me and give me a ride home. And then he would just talk about loneliness and wondering how people get up every day and function. At the time, I think I was working at Baskin Robbins, and he said, how do you do that when somebody comes into the store and asks for an ice cream? How do you do that and not just want to run out the back door? It was very frightening to think that the depression could be so incredibly powerful. And then it took a while, but he had therapy and medication and got markedly better.
I know he had really, really rocky times throughout all those years. There were years that were good. I mean, he got married and by all accounts had a really number of very stable, very happy years, which I think made all of his family and friends also very happy because it had taken him so long. What was David Foster Wallace as a happy and fulfilled family guy like?
It was neat to see. He definitely found the person for him in Karen, and she got him on every level. She thought it was absolutely great that he dressed the way that he did. And it was nice to see him so happy. And I think he finally felt like he spent most of his life really not feeling like a grown-up. And marrying Karen, I think, soothed that element of him.
So that the last year before his suicide sounds like things hit bottom again. The portrait that's kind of emerged of your brother is of a very, very brave, courageous person who tried to endure what felt unendurable and who finally really just couldn't take it anymore. At least that's kind of how it's been reported. How would you tell it?
That is exactly. That's. He was very brave. And he really did try so hard. When he did die, there was not a minute that I thought that I was angry at him or that if he'd only tried harder, I knew how hard he tried. I need a minute.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Yeah.
I just got a whole box of Kleenex brought to me.
So we don't leave you with you having to walk out there in tears. When you remember him and you want to remember the good parts and not feel sad, you know, and just remember him with some lightness in your heart, what sort of things do you think of?
Sometime in the 80s, we drove cross-country together. I was in school at Virginia at the time, and he was moving back to Tucson. And his radio was awful. It was an AM radio, and so we had this boom box with tapes in it, and we ran out of batteries at one point, and we were in Texas, and David didn't want to stop because we had to go at least 200 more miles before we could have dinner or whatever, you know, the fabulous prize was at the end there, and buy batteries. So he decided he was going to teach me to sing harmony, and I didn't want to learn how to sing harmony. And we were stuck in this tiny Volkswagen Rabbit in Texas as the sun was setting. And David had a lovely singing voice, and he was actually in the Glee Club at Amherst with Prince Albert of Monaco, actually. Little tidbit there. But so we're driving along, and David say, no, really, Amy, it's you can learn how to do this, and then we can just sing wonderful harmonies for the rest of the trip. And I said, I don't want to sing wonderful harmonies for the rest of the trip. I want to get batteries, you know. Let's just stop at the – I see a store right there. No, no, no. When I go, ah, you go, ah, you know. And this went on for 200 miles. And I – grudgingly tried to make reach the unlikely pitch he was expecting me to reach and sustain. And he did finally, thank God, give up on me. And I think he bought me a Hostess cupcake when we finally got the batteries and apologized. But I just think about that. And that's just kind of David in a nutshell. I am tone deaf. I was never going to learn how to sing harmony in that car. And I was pissed off. I didn't want to, but I will never forget that. And whenever I start thinking, you know, oh God, this is just so sad and this is so awful, I think of being in that Volkswagen Rabbit. And I think, you know, I will never, ever regret having David for a brother. And I've got wonderful memories, and I can still hear his voice in my head, not in a scary, mentally ill kind of way, but he had a very distinctive, soft, lovely voice. And whenever he'd call me on the phone, he'd say, hey, Aim. And once in a while, I just hear that. And, you know, he's there.
That's Amy Wallace Havens talking with us about her brother David Foster Wallace. We had that conversation about a year after his death. So we're getting near the end of this hour, and it's about time to say goodbye to David Foster Wallace. We thought we'd let him give us a send-off. This is from the commencement speech he gave at Kenyon College in Ohio in 2005. An audience member transcribed the speech from a videotape. For a while, it lived a second life on the internet and then was eventually published under the title, This is Water.
In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there is actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And a compelling reason for maybe choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it JC or Allah, be it Yahweh or the Wiccan mother goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some inviolable set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. Never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your own body and beauty and sexual allure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. Worship power, you will end up feeling weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to numb you to your own fear. Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out. Look, the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it is that they are unconscious. They are default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the so-called real world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings, because the so-called real world of men and money and power hums merrily along on the fuel of fear and anger and frustration and craving and the worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. The freedom all to be lords of our own tiny skull-sized kingdoms. This kind of freedom has much to recommend it. But of course, there are all different kinds of freedom. And the kind that is most precious, you will not hear much talked about much in the great outside world of wanting and achieving and displaying. The really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty little unsexy ways every day. That is real freedom.
That's David Foster Wallace giving the commencement speech at Kenyon College in 2005. His words are as true today as they were then. You can read the whole thing in a thin little book called This Is Water. That's it for our show today. But podcast listeners, if you'd like to hear more of To the Best of Our Knowledge, subscribe. And don't forget to leave a review. That helps other people find the show. And plus, we really like knowing what you think. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson and Veronica Rickard, with help from Craig Ely, Raymond Tankakar, Charles Monroe Kane, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen at Walk West Music. Joe Hartke was our engineer today. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.